excision number 16759, reel 2.
This camp you went to wasn't just a temporary camp on the way up. It was your permanent camp.
It was our permanent camp for several months. There we were segregated. The officers were in one part and the other ranks were in another. So we didn't meet them again, except when we were marched down to the square to have this indoctrination session.
Which camp was it? Did it have a name or number?
I don't know. I'm sure it did, but I don't know. It was below Pyongyang. But what its name and number was, I have no idea.
It was south of Pyongyang?
Yeah. And this is where they seem to be collecting people, because we got Americans there. We had South Africans. Air Force, South Africans. All sorts of people seem to join us there. And that's where they were losing a lot of people. And they were nearly, well, I think they were all American.
And it was just for officers?
Just for officers, our little bit. But there's a great big bit for the other ranks.
What were conditions like in this camp?
We were in little houses. Ours was a little square with houses all round, and you're on a dirt floor. We had to walk down to a river to wash. We had a trench as a latrine. By that time, of course, we were lousy. I think we'd probably got the lice from being in these shelters that the Chinese had occupied before us. So one of the things we had to do every day was to de-louse ourselves. And as I was saying, the only food we got was the sorghum. Wasn't any other food at all, apart from the green things we picked on our wood runs.
Were you doing medical work amongst your fellow POWs?
As much as I could without anything to do it with, yes. One of the, I mentioned before, an awful lot of dysentery or an awful lot of diarrhea, some of which was dysentery. And I can remember one instance of a Gloucester major who had bad dysentery. And we arranged for a whole lot of us to go on sick parade to get anti-dysentery pills to bring back enough to treat him. But that's about all you could do.
You were telling me earlier, off the record, about the way in which communist ideas of equality thwarted the effectiveness of some of your medical work.
Yeah.
If you could repeat that on the tape, please.
The Chinese seemed to get something like a 500-jar tablet, jar of tablets for dysentery. And depending on how many people turned up, they shared the diarrhea tablets out, which meant that probably each person got two tablets, which was a normal dose for these tablets would be eight a day, so that two per person was a complete waste of the medicines. But this was the Chinese communist principle of everybody must be equal, you all have equal amount of treatment.
it possible to reason or argue with them?
No, not at all. One thing with talking about beriberi, you need vitamin B for that. And we tried to get the Chinese to give us the ground-up rice husk, which is a bit of the rice grain that contains the vitamin B. And eventually they did. You got a little bit of newspaper with an amount of the ground-up rice husk if you went up with beriberi. But that took an awful long time before they understand that this is what we needed.
Seems surprising that living in a culture which depended so much on rice that they didn't know that as part of their traditional knowledge.
Well, yeah, I don't know what qualifications their doctors or medical orderlies had. I would think that it was mainly the barefoot doctors, which they used to call, who had a little knowledge of herbs, and that was about all. The other thing which comes into this, you see, because our guts were not used to sorghum, they went straight through. Now, if you're brought up on a diet of rice or sorghum, your gut is used to it, it can handle it, it'll get the nourishment out of it. When we first were POWs, you'd be eating 10, 12 bowls of the little Chinese bowls of the sorghum. And even then you weren't satisfied. Now, gradually our guts got used to this, and towards the end of captivity, you'd find that one bowl of rice, because we'd gone on to rice by then, was more than enough to make you feel that you'd had a decent meal. And so, from their point of view, they probably couldn't understand why we were getting beriberi, because we were getting the food, which, if it had been them, beriberi wouldn't have occurred. That makes sense.
It does. Was it possible, though, in general, to have a reasonable discussion with them?
No. Yeah, they. Well, I mean, I don't think they wanted, particularly me as a doctor, telling them how to do things. I think if they'd found out, for instance, that I asked a whole lot of people to go and get tablets and treat one person, I'd have been in the pokey for that. That's not communism.
What other medical conditions did you have to deal with?
Nothing really. We all had night blindness. Again, that's a vitamin B deficiency. I suppose the most important thing which I had to do was to make sure that people were delousing themselves properly, particularly the Americans. I suppose with their higher standard of living and so on and so forth, didn't fancy the idea of having lice and having to go with a hot coal along the seams of their clothing and killing off the eggs and the picking out the lice. One American artillery officer who was particularly reluctant to do this, I had to swear at him as a great big fat slob that I'd kick his ass all the way down to the river if he didn't do it. And I met him again at a reunion with the Gloucesters down in Cheltenham. And he came up to me and thanked me for having called him a big fat slob.
So it worked.
It worked on her, I wouldn't have kicked him all the way down. Because, I mean, for the sake of everybody else, everybody had to do it. But the Americans were a funny lot. We had one young Marine pilot who was 19, shot down, and he developed anorexia nervosa. He was either burying his food, or if he did eat any of it, he'd go around the back of the huts and vomit it back. And it was only very late on that we discovered this is what he was doing. And we tried to force feed him, but it wasn't any good. I think he just went and vomited it again. And in the end, we had to give him over to the Chinese, and he died of the anorexia. But I think that's... they don't expect the conditions to occur that they were under. I mean, they were awful conditions, dirty, scruffy. Not only did we have lice, we had bed bugs and fleas. And I don't think some of these young Americans could take that sort of living.
Why should the British POWs have been able to take it then?
Well, I think they come from a different... I mean, almost all the people who were in 29 Brigade were reservists. They fought in the Second World War, and they'd been under severe conditions, and so they knew what dirty conditions were like. And they accepted, you know, all right, you've got lice, you've got to get rid of your lice.
Was it typhus you were worried about?
Yeah.
Did you get it?
No. Again, the Chinese were very good. We had, we were all re-immunized by the Chinese, including one for plague, because their story was that the Americans dropped plague germs on the Chinese troops. And I believe it was the Chinese troops brought plague in with them when they came into Korea. But we're all immunized against plague and typhus. Still have my little immunization card.
Did you ever have any cases of bubonic plague?
No. Mind you, we didn't mix with anybody. We didn't see Korean civilians at all.
How can you account for that U.S. pilot who got anorexia?
He's a young Marine, and they're fairly, elite lot of people. Now, first of all, he'd been shot down, presumably by a Chinaman, which wouldn't do his morale very much good. And then coming up to the conditions that we were living in, I think he just couldn't take it. He opted out.
Did you use that term in those days?
No. To us, I don't think it had been concocted. But I mean, now, the fact that he wouldn't eat and vomited food back is either anorexia or bulimia or whatever you like to call it. And certainly he died.
What psychological conditions did you have to deal with, if any?
Among the British troops?
Among any.
British troops, really nothing. They're a tough lot. You know, they're reservists from the Second World War. The Americans could easily become depressed. We had one little coloured lieutenant who went completely balmy. He was drilling his lice. He took them off himself and put them on the ground and was drilling them, giving them orders. He died as well, I'm afraid. I think under those conditions, if your mental state goes, physically you go as well. And there's nothing you can do about it.
What was the attitude of the Chinese to mental cases?
I have no idea. Once it was realized that he'd gone bonkers, this chap, they took him away. He didn't, and the hospital or the place where they kept them, which was a big Korean house, a temple or something like that, was quite a long way away from where we were. So what happened, and we know that they died. The Chinese are very good at giving you bad news. Never used to give you good news.
Were people able to keep in contact with home?
Yes and no. Thinking of... we were... Where did we start being a... We weren't allowed to write until we got to the next camp, which was up near the Yalu, right up in the north. But there you started being allowed to write letters home. And according to my wife, I think it was 6 months before she had any news that I was alive. And then we started to get letters coming in at very regular intervals from that time onwards. And they were usually, certainly 3 months out of date. And we got pictures. My wife used to include pictures of my two children. Then there was a boy and a girl by then.
So were they proper letters or just...
Oh yes, proper letters. Yeah.
Did they have to be censored?
Oh yes, they were all censored. I think that's why it took so long to...
Did they have things cut out when you got them?
No. I don't know who did the censoring. I don't know whether they could even read English. Are you meant to know that we could send coded messages home and that coded messages could come through to us? Are you meant to know that or not?
I know there was an organization called MI something or other which used to arrange this type of thing. I think that's fairly well known.
Yeah, well... I don't know how many of us were given code words to use to write a coded thing in your letters home. And right at the very end, just before we were released, it was after the peace treaty had been agreed, or the armistice, I got a letter from home. Which was all about cricket, how everybody was getting on and who'd done this, who'd done that, and what 11s were playing, which 11s, and all that sort of thing. which was from somebody I have no idea who in the hell it was, but it was a coded message to say that a patrol would be passing 2 miles south of the camp on such and such a date. I think that was 2 or 3 months out of date, so that it had already passed by long before the letter came through. But one thing which...
What kind of patrol?
It just said a patrol would be passing through.
And that an Allied patrol?
Oh, yes. No, Allied patrol, one of ours. If you could get people the 2 miles south, they could rendezvous with the patrol and get taken out. But this is one of the things which annoyed me about army personnel. I've hated cricket all my life. And if we'd been properly interrogated, it would probably have come out somehow or other, talking with interrogators, that I didn't like cricket. And for somebody to write a letter which was all about cricket to me, if the censor had been good, interrogators had been good, they would have picked that up. And that chap, instead of doing that, could have rung my wife up and said, could you tell me the sort of things your husband's interested in? I mean, obviously, he was interested in cricket. But instead of doing that, he wrote this blooming letter all about cricket. You know, you wonder how many other cock-ups like that occur. Anyway, that's by the by. But yes, I mean, there was, particularly towards the end, information was coming in to us, and our information, mind you, our information was very circumspect, that we were all perfectly all right and the Chinese were being kind to us, and nothing that would make them remove the letter from that delivery.
Coming back to interrogation, why was their interrogation so amateurish? In what way was their interrogation so amateurish?
Well, I mean, the chap who did mine, as I said, was a schoolmaster from some little village in China who didn't know anything about anything. He's as bad as I am. I was. He was doing the interrogation. Mind you, he had forms which you had to fill in. So whether that went somewhere or other to somebody who knew. Or whether, I mean, once they realized I knew nothing, they probably didn't bother with me very much. I don't know. I mean, who knows the mind of a Chinaman? Or the Chinese, I should say, shouldn't I?
Can you tell me more about the indoctrination and the way in which they went about it?
The only indoctrination we had was this: everybody was marched down to this square. We all sat on the ground in long rows, and the camp commander would do his spiel about the Chinese people's volunteers, and the fact that we were war criminals and we should never have come to Korea, we invaded them, and everything that the Chinese were doing for the Koreans, and the what they'd done in China, and all about communism. And this was all interpreted by one of the interpreters, and you'd have about 2 hours of this just sitting there. That's all we had.
Did they tell you anything you didn't already know?
Yeah, I didn't think I knew very much about China when I went there. I didn't know very much about communism either.
Was any of it of any interest to you?
No. We weren't in the frame of mind to be interested in anything at that stage. I was interested later on when we went to the main camp. We started getting literature as well about Russia and communism and Marx and Lenin's and all their little pamphlets that distributed, and I got quite interested reading those.
Do you remember any of the titles that you read?
No. I mean, they weren't books, they were little pamphlets. Marx and Engels, and I don't think we had anything from Stalin. I don't know whether you could write even, but it was mainly the Marx Engels and their pamphlets on all the various little bits, a little subject.
Any pamphlets by Mao Zedong?
No. And we didn't get the little red book either. And they didn't have the little red book. I don't know when the little red book
came. I think it
came
in the 60s.
Was it?
Were any amongst you influenced, do you think, by the ideas?
No, I doubt. Certainly, you're talking about the first camp we went to now, are you?
At any stage?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I know some were influenced. I mean, some stayed behind in China. But none, I don't think any of the, at the third camp that we went to the annex. We moved to an annex of the second main camp, moved into an annex. And there, certainly there was one American colored officer who, whether he was influenced by better rations or whether he was influenced by their doctrine, I don't know. But he certainly gave information to the Chinese about things that we were doing, storing food, making biltong. We were making, by that time we were getting a pig about once a month, and we used to get strips of pig and try and dry it into biltong for escape rations. And I understand that one or two escape plans were leaked by this chap to the Chinese. But as far as I know, that's the only person. And for what motives, I have no idea.
Was that escape preparations of the British or Americans?
Both.
Or
both. I think he was court-martialed when they got him home.
Were you involved in escape preparations or attempts?
Only in the food, trying to dry this pork meat into biltongs.
Was it not successful?
Yeah, I think it was. It was never used. It dried out all right. Trouble was, all these things were... We were getting round to it by the time the armistice...